This podcast of The Exchange is sponsored by Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Opportunity.
And the Dagoba Group, a global diversity and inclusion consulting practice with specialties in unconscious bias, leadership dynamics, and client engagement. Authors of the book, The Inclusion Dividend. More at thedagobagroup.com.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us. A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come. Information at imagine.d-h.org.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Canoy, and this is The Exchange. Some call it the leaky pipeline, the steady drop-off of women pursuing degrees and then careers in science, technology, engineering, and math. These gaps regarding women and men in the so-called STEM fields have been well publicized and talked about for years. And while in some subject areas they no longer exist, the disparity remains stark in others, especially in the fields of computer science and engineering. But the question of why that is remains unclear. Is it discouragement from a young age, lack of support networks in high school and university, lack of interest by female students themselves, or an inherent sexism? Meanwhile, as some researchers continue to ponder that question, others now say the gap is overblown, maybe non-existent, with one recent study even finding a bias in STEM hiring skewing towards women. Today in The Exchange, where are the women in science? Or at this point in time, is that the wrong question to ask? Let's hear from you. The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. We have three guests for the hour with me in studio. Melissa Jerkois, Technical Products Manager at Newmarket and Amadeus Company. That's a computer software firm in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. Melissa, it's nice to meet you. Thank you for being here.
Thanks.
Also with us, Micheline Dufort, Director of Business Relations and Programs at the New Hampshire High Tech Council, which oversees the Tech Women, Tech Girls program to promote girls in STEM fields. Again, STEM being science, technology, engineering, and math. And Micheline, good to see you. Thank you for being here as well.
Thank you, Laura.
And joining us from Hanover, Professor Ann Kapuscinski, Professor of Environmental Studies and the Sherman Fairchild Distinguished Chair of Sustainability Science at Dartmouth College. And Professor Kapuscinski, thank you also for being with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Laura.
Well, without diving into the numbers, Professor Kapuscinski and all of you, what do you think about this idea of a gap? Some people nowadays say it's a myth, it doesn't exist. Other people say, yes, there is, but it's not as much as it used to be. Others say it depends on the field you're looking at. Just from your own experience, Professor Kapuscinski, what do you think? Is there a STEM gap between men and women or not?
Well, from my own experience, I'd say that it really does depend on what field you're looking at. I've seen a sea change in the field that I'm in, which broadly defined as the environmental sciences. When I first started in graduate school back in the late 1970s, I was definitely one of the rare few. For example, I was the first woman graduate student to seek a PhD with my major advisor. I was the first woman hired in my first assistant professor position in a Department of Fisheries and Wildlife at the University of Minnesota. But today, we have a lot of women who are seeking bachelor's degrees and also graduate degrees in the environmental sciences fields. But when I talk to colleagues who are in fields like physics and chemistry, I know a little less about computer science and engineering, but my sense is that there definitely are fewer women in those fields.
Yeah, and we'll talk about this a little bit later, too, the experience of women who, you know, got their degrees and started studying in the 60s, 70s, maybe even 80s. But just real quickly, Professor Kapuscinski, what was that like to be the only woman in the room?
Well, there were times when it was uncomfortable and fairly scary. I think I was very fortunate that I also had some amazing male mentors who really believed in me and sort of looked out for me all along the way. But I definitely had some uncomfortable experiences.
Wow. Well, what do you think, Micheline Dufort? Again, without getting into the, the nitty-gritty numbers, do you think that there's a gap or not?
You know, I think there is, Laura. Certainly, as the professor said, there is a sea change. And I think a lot of it is because a lot of light is being shed on it and there's a lot of conversations. But I know from the High Tech Council, there's about 45,000 people in the state working in high tech. We think we mirror the data nationally that about 20 to 30% of those folks are female. We know, too, from our higher ed partners, the people coming in are lower. The females are lower. About 18 to 20% of people, of females, are taking those tracks.
And wow, so that's not a lot.
Yeah, so there is a gap. Even if you go down to AP test takers, the number of female students electing to take the computer science degree, it's 7 to 1 men to women, young men to women taking those tests. So we know that there's a gap. We do.
Well, here's some numbers from the National Science Foundation. This is the percentage of bachelor's degrees in a STEM field, again, science, technology, engineering, and math, received by a woman. In some fields, women are actually above men in psychology and biosciences. Slightly in the social sciences, there's more women. With math and physical sciences, it's slightly less than half. And then, as everybody's been saying so far, computer sciences and engineering, it's very low for female participation. And Melissa Jerkois, you're working in this field. I wonder what you see.
I see it every day. It's very real. There's no question in my mind there's a gap. Every meeting I'm in, just the other day I was in a meeting and there was about 24 people in the room, only female.
Really?
And that's my every day. So I'm living it. So proof. There's a gap.
Tell us a little bit about the field that you're working in so we can get a sense of, where this gap is the biggest.
Sure. So I started out as an engineer. So I was software engineer for about 13 years. I've been at Newmarket, an Amadeus company, for 16 years now. And I moved into product management in a technical capacity. So both in product management and in the engineering field within my own company, there's a huge gap. And I think what's interesting is when I started back in 99 during the dot-com boom, there was more females that I was working alongside in engineering, doing web development, because that was a huge thing back then. And I've seen that decline even within my own experience in the last 20 years.
Well, it's real interesting that you say that, because, again, here's that National Science Foundation data. Engineering is slightly more female heavy than it was in 1991, but not by much, 15.5% then versus 18% in 2010. But then two decades ago, this lines up perfectly with what you just said, women received almost 30% of computer science BAs, and today it's 18%. So it seems like, Melissa, women are not only not joining these fields, they're turning away.
They are. Yeah, I agree. And I think it's part of what's great about the Tech Women, Tech Girls initiative through the High Tech Council is we need to get to them and provide an environment that's safe to learn. So, again, I mirror what the professor said about going through school and being the only female in class. I had the same experience at UNH here in Durham.
What does that mean? I'll turn to you first, I think, Micheline. A safe environment, a comfortable environment. Mm. It is, kind of uncomfortable to be the only female in the room with 24 guys.
Absolutely.
I mean, some people might not be bothered by it, but a lot of people would be.
Mm-hmm. I think a lot of it comes down to perception. And it looks like for a lot of young women, what does that career look like? So the whole Tech Women, Tech Girls that we're doing, and a lot of other groups are doing similar things, I liken it to show and tell. So if you have a woman like Melissa or so many of these wonderful female technologists I work with spend some time at that very crucial juncture for young women, you're going to make an impression that will stay with them. And it's breaking down those perceptions. What could that career look like? What could I do? What I don't understand. That's something that they can't see the future. And so that's really what the program is all about for us.
What do you think, Professor Kapuscinski? You're in academics. Go ahead.
Yeah, thank you for asking me because I wanted to jump in. I think that point about just by virtue of being a woman and being in a more senior position, you really do provide an incredibly powerful model for other young women. I experienced this really sort of by default when I first started as an assistant professor in 1984 at the University of Minnesota, and I was just focused on doing my science and going through all the things you have to do to make sure I earn tenure as an assistant professor. And without even realizing it, just my mere existence, I discovered then fairly quickly, was a really powerful signal to women. What would happen when I would be assigned undergraduate students to be their advisor, as they were starting as freshmen, they would come in the room to meet with me, and their jaws would drop because they didn't realize at first that their advisor would be a woman. And it then became very clear that just my being physically there started inspiring other women. And you know, I think I was part of a national trend because within 4 years of my being in that faculty position, we were now accepting many more women who wanted to go to graduate school in our department. We had many more women who were being majors. By the time I left that university to come to Dartmouth, that was in 2009, there was actually a greater majority of our majors, both at the undergraduate and the graduate level, were women. So I think it's really true. If you're just there doing the job of being a scientist and just going about your business doing that, and then to also take the time to sort of mentor the women who you see are really interested, but just your mere presence and just doing a good job sends an extremely strong signal.
Again, our phone number here in the Exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Today in the Exchange, we're looking at the gap between women and men in so-called STEM fields, science, technology, engineering, and math. Hearing that the gap has closed in some areas, but in others it's quite low. In fact, maybe the gap is even getting bigger in some fields like engineering or computer science. The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. If you are a woman working in tech or you're a young woman studying and thinking about a STEM career, let's hear from you. What questions, comments, concerns do you have? 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Here's another question for all of you. If there is a gap in some fields, and it sounds like you're saying there is, Micheline, to you first, but I want to hear from everybody. Why is this important? For example, teaching is a heavily female-dominated profession, but, you know, there aren't studies and funding and special programs on let's bring more men into teaching. So why is this so important, women in STEM? Why does it matter?
Well, it matters on a lot of levels. And even if you back up just a little, it matters for New Hampshire overall. We actually have a need for more tech workers of all type. It is a fast-growing sector. It is a sector that is driving the economy. And we don't have a job creation problem in our area. We actually have a filling the job problem.
In the tech field.
There's about 2,000 positions, tech positions, on any given time, any month, open. And traditionally, there being about 1,600 are being filled. We need tech workers. And there's a lot being done with higher ed and another different partners. But why this is important is because, again, there's so much opportunity overall that one way to be able to fill those gaps is to encourage women to take a stronger look at this field and join that pipeline of tech workers that we need.
So not enough well-educated tech workers in the pipeline here in the Granite State. And if half of the population, meaning the female half, is feeling shut out, that's not good for business.
Exactly. I know that the tech companies we work with, if you ask them what are their concerns, workforce is always at the top of the list. All workforce, obviously.
Melissa, let's hear from you on that, too. Why does this matter? I mean, you could say, all right, some fields are female-dominated, some fields are male-dominated. Why is this such a big deal?
Well, I think that females have a different perspective to add to the field that I just don't think is being fulfilled, and I don't think it's being recognized as a loss. But I think if you look at some of the interesting things that are being published now about female entrepreneurs in startups and tech startups specifically, and they have done studies to show the difference between how those companies perform and how investors will actually love to invest. I think there was an article with Mark Cuban actually saying, I would invest in a company that was started by a female 10 times over because they are much more productive and they show revenue on investment within 12 months. So there's different things like that that come out. And I think in general, the more that we have, again, 50% of the population, just if they're female and we aren't giving them opportunities, then that's 50% of the population that won't have that kind of opportunity and career. So, I think there's a one quote that I'll say just because I'm a mother of three and I kind of started my career as a single mom and moved up. And it's, if you want something done, give it to a busy mom. And so you can't really say that. I'm not saying you can't say that for
men. Yeah, what about a busy
men,
dad, right?
But I think, you know, there's a lot to be said there. I think women in general, it's genetics. It's a fact. We're just really good at multitasking. We have the ability to juggle multiple things. We're kind of hardwired that way. And not, you know, not being feminist about it, but just being real, right? I think my husband, who's probably listening right now, would totally agree with me. It's just something that we can do. And I think we're losing out when we're not giving opportunities to females in technical careers.
So there may be problems that remain unsolved, and a female brain just, you know, who knows, wired differently or looking at things differently may be able to figure it out just because she has a different perspective. Okay. And companies are missing out on that.
Yes. Yes, I totally think so.
What do you think, Professor Kapuscinski? We're wading into some tricky territory here when we start talking about female brains and male brains, and I've got another question on that, but go ahead.
Yeah. Well,
like,
I
why
guess
does
I
this
would,
matter, too? You know, like,
yeah,
why should
I think
we be
it really
concerned
matters.
About this?
I think it matters for two reasons. First, you know, I've definitely noticed that women just tend to bring a diverse set of perspectives to the actual approach of doing the research on the scientific questions, even to the framing of the scientific questions. But I've also noticed that when women are in the faculty in a department, I've noticed this both at Dartmouth and in my prior position, it somehow changes the dynamics of how the whole group makes decisions. And, you know, it feels more real because, you know, as we all know, 50% of the population are women. So the group feels like it's more connected to reality when you have also some women in the room. But also, you know, at the risk of overgeneralizing, I think women's presence in a group when we're trying to make decisions about curriculum and other kinds of decisions that we make in academia, we tend to think about things in a more connected way. We tend to emphasize, you know, can we make decisions in a collaborative way, more by consensus? We have a tendency to kind of try to lower the hierarchy of the decision-making process. And again, I'm overgeneralizing because I also know men who do that very well. But I think having women there just changes the dynamic. And then the second reason is that there are young women who are really passionately interested in these different scientific fields, and they need women in positions of leadership who can be there as mentors for them. You know, even though I was saying a few minutes ago that we now see a lot of women in the environmental sciences fields, that doesn't mean that someone like in my position, and I should probably add that, you know, in my department, we have two women faculty members, so we're still a minority. We're a fairly small department, but there's, I think we have 8 or 9 tenured positions, and we have 2 of them are women. So I still play, and I actually find it extremely rewarding. I play a very important role in being a mentor to young women who are interested in a career in the environmental sciences and are wondering if it's feasible. So if I wasn't there, you know, I think that that would become a barrier for them. And, you know, potentially things could slide back, like our colleagues are saying have happened in the tech field.
Again, our phone number is 1-800-892-6477. Let's get your take on this topic of women in science, technology, engineering, and math. 1-800-892-6477. Darlene joins us from Haverhill. Hi, Darlene. Go ahead. You're on The Exchange.
Hello.
Hi. Go ahead, Darlene.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Go ahead.
Okay. I'm wondering if we follow the money path, if we may find some answers there, because I'm a physician. And I applied to medical school many years ago when the percentage of women in medical school was around 3%. By the time I actually went to medical school, women were the majority of the students. And I believe at that time it's because it's very difficult to make a lot of money in medicine now due to the insurance situation and all those other things. Have to wait a long time to be paid. You only paid a certain percent of what one would expect. So I believe that there's been a white flight of white males out of medicine and into more lucrative situations. So I'm wondering if they're entering technology and engineering at a larger percentage than before and pushing the women out.
All right. Well, Darlene, thank you for calling in, given your experience. Do you want to comment, Micheline?
Well, sure. I think it comes back to that conversation about perception and what leadership roles are shared mentorship with young women to know what that career could look like. Average salary for a high-tech worker in New Hampshire is about $100,000. And so that obviously, if as Darlene said, follow the money, that's a great thing. And so those relationships that build as young women look at what they want to do, that's a part of the conversation. One of my committee members had a really fun idea, said, you know, if we want to tell young people, all young people, what a career in tech could look like, we should go over to one of our tech companies and take a look at the parking lot and look at the cars that are coming in and the type of cars. It gives a sense of lifestyle that there's a really good lifestyle with a tech career here in New Hampshire. Absolutely.
Well, but you got to love what you do.
You got to love what you do, which is the bigger part.
If you're driving a nice car and right. don't enjoy playing with computers, then you're not going to be happy. And we're going to talk about that in just a moment. We'll take more of your calls. Darlene, thank you for that one. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. More in a moment. Stay with us. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, they call it the leaky pipeline that's said to be draining women from STEM fields, science, technology, engineering, and math. As we're hearing, it's a little more complicated than that, with women dominating in some STEM fields and men in others. Let's hear from you. The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. 1-800-892-6477. And Professor Kapuscinski, Melissa Jerkoys, Micheline Dufort, let's go back to our listeners for a moment. And David's joining us from Concord. Hi, David. Go ahead. You're in The Exchange.
Hi. Yeah, I just wanted to comment on how men and women and interest has a lot to do with the careers that they go into, and how I remember that my cousin's three girls were playing one day, playing dolls. And the youngest, who's a boy, was not really paying attention, just kind of doing his own thing. And a garbage truck pulled up out front, and the boy dropped everything, ran to the window, and just stared at the garbage truck. The three girls just kept playing, didn't even notice. And I think that has a lot to do with what career you go into. It's just basic interest in how your brain works.
Well, David, this is a great point, and I did want to bring this up with the three of you. So we've talked about, you know, some girls don't choose these careers because they feel funny, they're the only girl or woman in the room, or they feel discouraged and so forth. What about this idea that, women are just more hardwired to be interested in fields that allow them to interact with people, and men just tend to be, broadly generalizing here because we've got Melissa who's working in computer sciences, tend to focus on fields that that work with objects. We really should tackle this. So thank you, David. And Professor Kapuscinski, I'm going to throw it to you first. Go ahead. What do you think?
I have to answer that really just based on my own experience because I don't know what the research is on that. But I can think back to when I went to college. I went to Swarthmore College, very high-powered, small liberal arts college. And I remember having a friend who was passionate about engineering, a woman, and she excelled in the engineering major there. And, you know, I don't remember feeling that there was something about her brain that made it hard for her to do engineering. I don't know what the statistics are about our engineering gender ratio at Dartmouth, but I have encountered quite a number of engineering undergraduate students there. Some of them have taken courses from me in the environmental sciences, and they seem incredibly bright and very good at what they do. So I'm a little skeptical that there's something hardwired in your brain. I think it's maybe more cultural signals.
I'm sure
that both within men and within women, there probably are a diversity of interest. I can remember some childhood friends who from early age wanted to be an astronomer. I, from a very early age, was fascinated by whales and, you know, eventually went into fisheries, and then that led me to sustainability science. So we do have things that at very early in life you get super excited about, but I don't know if that falls cleanly between male and female lines.
Yeah, and I would never I don't think anybody would ever say women can't do engineering. I think David's point is he's saying, look, just basic personality, women tend to be less interested in engineering. Now, I'm not saying that, but that's his point. And I do have some an article here from Denise Cummins, who's looked at this. And she says that the problem with this blank slate interpretation of gender differences is that it doesn't jibe with results of developmental studies. Newborn girls, I'm quoting here, prefer to look at faces, while newborn boys prefer to look at mechanical stimuli. And she says this holds out true for juvenile monkeys as well, who haven't even been socialized. Now, again, we'll never probably answer this question to anybody's satisfaction, but Micheline Dufort, I do wonder what you think. It's not that women can't do computers and engineering. It's just that David thinks, and I've heard other people say, they just tend to be less interested. You can do all the girls in tech programs that you want, but they're just going to be less interested. This is very controversial, by the way.
Oh, absolutely. And that's where education about the careers is so important. You know, the tech companies that I work with are extremely collaborative environments. And so they, you know, everyone has a role, but for a tech company to hum and thrive the way it needs to, you need to call on all. And so I think that we should look at it as a career in tech. Obviously, you need to have your area of expertise. But it's pretty collaborative to make things work. You know, even if you look at a tech company, people in sales and marketing at a tech company are absolutely essential to the process. So, you know, we sometimes think, oh, coders, coding, God, what that job.
Staring at a screen all day.
Yeah, that's one of many, many, many jobs of engineers and software. So I think maybe we are a little hardwired different, but I think everyone has something to bring to the party, if you will.
Go ahead, Melissa.
So I would say it's interesting because I agree with David. So I was a young girl and I thought I was going to be a teacher and I would set up my dolls and teach them. So I totally hear exactly what he's saying. But what I would say is I didn't know that I had any sort of interest or skill or even a gift, I would say, in engineering or programming until my senior year of high school.
Really?
Wow. Because I had no exposure to it. So, I mean, I took a small class. I mean, back then we did typing on a typewriter. So our computer room had, you know, four or five computers in it. And I sat in that class and my teacher said in high school, wow, you have a knack for this. And I fell in love with it. I was hooked. That wasn't from, when I was a little girl. I was playing with dolls and I was teaching and I was convinced I was going to be a teacher. At that point, I had already applied to school and I was an English major. So I didn't realize
but
I wanted...
You were an English major?
I started as an English major. It took me pretty much my entire college career to change over to a science degree, which is probably a whole nother radio show. But it was challenging. So I guess I'm saying I'm proof that you don't necessarily grow up that way. So we may be very well hardwired, and I think David has a really good point. You know, that's how I grew up. But I've also seen some girls that are very interested in building Legos and creating things and using Kinects and all those different things that actually are more of an engineering capacity. So I think it's more of an individual basis. But I do still think that women bring a different thing to the table, to what Michelin was saying, to kind of piggyback on that. The collaboration is, I want women to know in STEM that when they go into these careers, you know, I started out as an engineer and I was programming in my cubicle. But now I'm sitting on stage at our customer conferences in front of 300 people giving presentations and talking about things that are highly technical, but making them relatable to people. So there's a place for us in these roles.
Well, David, it's a great question. Thank you very much for bringing it to the table, as we've been saying. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Join us as we look at some of the issues and discussions surrounding women in STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math, 1-800-892-6477. All of you joining us now on the phone is Elaine Zundel. She's research director at the Center for Women and Work at Rutgers University. Elaine's expertise includes research and evaluation of programs that recruit and retain women in engineering and computing at the undergraduate level. Again, those are the two fields especially where there are so few women. And Elaine Zundel, thank you very much for being with us. We appreciate it.
Oh, thank you so much.
Well, we've been talking about so much attention has been paid to this issue with grants and programs and special efforts. You've looked at how well these programs work or don't work. You're looking specifically at these two fields where there is such a low percentage of women. What have you found, Elaine, about what tends to keep women in these professions?
Well, creating an environment where women can essentially, you know, feel less isolated. So if you look at the undergraduate level, there are a lot of opportunities for women to be essentially – sorry, I have an echo here – to essentially find out what – to experiment with what kinds of curriculum influence them or excite them, and then find a safe haven at the university to explore that interest.
A safe haven. What does that mean, Elaine, exactly?
Well, we know that there's an implicit bias within a lot of disciplines to associate them with men or masculinity. And so if we're able to create an environment where women feel safe to express any kind of pressure or stress or alienation that they feel inside the discipline, it helps them to feel more confident, to reach out for resources when they need it and not feel that they're burdening themselves to try to disprove any negative stereotypes that might be in the environment about women in STEM.
So it's tiring to feel like you always have to prove yourself.
That's right. I mean, we see even with very, very successful women at the undergraduate level and in high school, they often have to compete more and more to feel that they're accepted or that they're a real scientist, even though, you know, their grades might be very, very high. They'll report on surveys that they that they don't feel very confident in their ability.
Well, as we said, there's a lot of, you know, money, attention, energy being focused on this issue. And you're talking about what works, Elaine. What doesn't work? What sort of well-meaning efforts have really just not panned out?
Well, I think there's an aspect of painting everything pink or making things more.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I've seen campaigns, especially the European Union was guilty of this, where they released a campaign that basically, you know, took all these kind of tropes about what we think of being girly and then trying to make it put STEM into this pink lipstick kind of environment and, you know, put that in a popular media campaign, which ended up really turning a lot of girls off, as if somehow if we made STEM more feminine, that girls would be more interested. So that kind of paints the picture that there's something wrong with girls, that girls don't, you know, need this to be pink or girly or else they're not going to be interested, that they're not going to be drawn to STEM just because STEM is interesting or they're interested in solving, you know, scientific problems. So, you know, we have to get away from this idea that there's something wrong with girls, that they're not interested. We know that they're interested. Surveys of young girls have shown that they're really drawn to STEM in high school and middle school. But the problem is, you know, they're dealing with a lot of negative stereotypes. They're also being micro-messaged. They're being told that, you know, they're probably better at English or the humanities or the social sciences. And, you know, unless there's a real cultural shift, we're not going to see any great gains in engineering and computing.
What about the phrase, I wonder how you feel about this, Elaine, the leaky pipeline, that slowly female students, as you said, who, you know, are interested earlier on, that slowly female students drop out of these fields, leak out of the pipeline, so to speak. How do you feel about that description?
So I think pathways, creating career pathways, is a better analogy, because in some instances, like in engineering, we see that the women who are interested in engineering in high school actually tend to persist quite far. The workforce is a different kind of issue. But, you know, in that instance, younger women decide that engineering is for them, they actually tend to go quite far. They even tend to go pursue graduate school at higher rates than their male peers. But, you know, the issue is that more women, besides those few women that identify with being an engineer when they're young, are not being exposed to it, are not having, they're not being mentored in quite the same way that their male peers are. So if we create pathways, career pathways, where students can see how to enter the field, they can be shown that they'll be supported once they begin studying in the field, this will ultimately help them to visualize themselves being successful in the future.
Pathways that aren't necessarily painted pink.
Yeah.
Elaine.
Yeah.
Thank you very much for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
That's Elaine Zundel, again, research director at the Center for Women and Work at Rutgers. She's looked at programs that recruit and retain women in engineering and computing. Let's hear from you, too. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Before we go back to our listeners, Michelle, I do have to turn to you. Again, you are working on one of these programs, mm-hmm. Tech Women, Tech mm-hmm. Girls with the High Tech Council. What do you think about that? You know, encouraging women to go into these fields, but you don't have to paint them pink.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. We don't have to paint them pink. They're there. They're great programs and great interest to and abilities are there. I think it's back to the exposure. And I think Elaine actually just said that, too. And that's why some of the things that we've done is create vehicles to have that exposure at those critical junction with those young females who are looking at or interested in computing and engineering.
Let's take another call. And this is Deborah in Londonderry. Hi, Deborah. Go ahead. You're in the exchange.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Sure.
I'm calling because my daughter is a junior in high school right now, and she is currently taking honors and AP level science classes and is interested in pursuing a science degree in college. And what she's looking for now is opportunities for job shadows, opportunities where she could actually maybe do a job shadow or an internship while she's in high school so she can get an idea of what this field would look like and guide maybe her choice of what she actually does pursue in college.
So I'm interested in this call, and I'll ask our guests about your question, Deborah, but what about this idea of, you know, women in STEM? What do you think, Deborah, as someone who has a young woman now interested in this, do you see some of the same problems that Professor Kapuscinski talked about, you know, back in the 70s? Or do you think it's pretty open these days towards girls doing these fields?
I haven't noticed it at all with my daughter. I mean, she has been, she is an all-around good student. She's good in all topics, but her interest has been in science all along. I mean, she's taking organic chemistry this year and is really excited about it. And she, by the way, played with dolls all the time as a child. So, it's more that she's looking, you know, she's just not sure how she would be able to get an opportunity to actually see what it's like for a woman working in a STEM field.
Okay, well, and I don't want to keep picking on you, Micheline, but why don't you jump on that real quick, and then I have another question for you, Professor Kapuscinski, but go ahead.
Absolutely. You know, and I can give you one instance. The Department of Education here in New Hampshire has created a thing called Girls Tech Day, and that is every March, and it has grown. I think it's in its fourth year. It's grown every year, where it is looking at students like your daughter through their school to come to this very comprehensive and all-hands-in experiential day in tech, where there's companies there with their gadgets and their gear and the things that they produce. There's software application people to represent that, and it's now on college campuses, and last year there were 500 young women who came. And they find other women like themselves, like this caller's daughter, where they say, aha, and they can make those relationships. Because I will tell you, through the High Tech Council, there is a huge appetite among female technologists to share with what they've been through and what they have learned.
Professor Kapuscinski, what about Deborah's comment that she doesn't see at this point in time, you know, here we are, 2015, any sort of, you know, teachers discouraging her daughter, people putting her down, saying, don't do this. I've heard horror stories like yours from the 60s and 70s where, you know, women were routinely said, you shouldn't do this. But I wonder if that really is still the case now.
Well, I can, you know, reflect on what I see sort of the attitude of the young women who come in as freshmen to Dartmouth or who I interact with, you know, let's say starting their sophomore or junior year. They definitely have a very confident sort of can-do approach. Many of them, I noticed it never even crossed their mind that maybe there'd be a question about whether they could be in this field because they're a woman. But at the same time, I do see that some of them, when they then get, you know, they commit themselves to doing a major, let's say, in environmental studies, which is my department, or in biology, some other fields where they often will take maybe a minor or do research with people in environmental studies. Once they sort of commit themselves and start digging in deeper, they sometimes fall prey to what's referred to as the imposter syndrome. They start questioning, you know, am I really going to be able to succeed at this? Am I good enough at it? They start worrying about whether they can be competitive enough. And it's at times like that when they start to waver that then it's so important to have somebody like me there to sort of reassure them, you know, show them how they should take advantage of networking to actually sort of advance themselves. So I see it as sort of, it's not black or white. It's we're sort of in this in-between period where definitely young women now have much more confidence and I think are getting fewer signals that they shouldn't even pursue this. There are many of them just take it as a matter of course that they can, but they're still getting some negative signals once they sort of commit themselves to the field, and that's why it's really important to have some women who can be mentors for them.
Okay, well, Deborah, thank you for that call, and a lot more of your calls and comments after a break. 1-800-892-6477. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, a look at the gender gap in STEM fields, science, technology, engineering, and math, and what's often called the leaky pipeline that's supposedly draining women from STEM fields. Now, the picture is changing as we're hearing with our guests, and let's hear from you, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And all of you, let's go right back to our listeners. And Alan's joining us from New Boston. Hi, Alan. Go ahead. You're in The Exchange. Welcome. Okay, Alan, I hope that you call back. Again, the number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. We actually have another caller from New Boston. Elaine is calling in. Go ahead, Elaine. You're on the air.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. What a
sure.
great program. Very exciting. I run a nonprofit called Girls at Work, and we empower girls through building. We give girls as young as 6 years old power tools, keeping them safe, and we expose them to the incredible potential that exists within them. And I think if they don't see the potential early on, they're not going to see these fields as an option.
So show them early or they won't see the fields as an option. And you're nodding, Melissa. You told us your story earlier about how you never even thought about this early on.
I agree. I think part of it was just the age I grew up in as well. But I think being exposed to it, that was huge for me. If I was never exposed to it that time in high school, I would have stayed in liberal arts. I would never have ventured into a computer science degree. So I think that's huge.
Thank you for the call, Elaine. Did you want to jump in, Micheline?
Well, I do. I'm so glad to hear about that program. And one of the things that we have done is started working with, there are so many programs like that. Even if you think about the Girl Scouts, they have changed much of what they do, the Boys and Girls Clubs, to be able to integrate STEM exposure, whether it's power tools, whether it's robotics, whatever it may be, into their programming to really augment what's going on in the schools at a young age.
Here's an email that came in from Lindsay that I want to share with you. She says, I'm a young professional in ocean science and engineering, which is a male-dominated field. I go to sea for 3 to 4 weeks at a time, a few times a year, and I'm usually one of 2 to 3 women on a ship of 40 to 50. I recently turned 30, and I've started thinking about having a family in a few years. Being in this field stresses me out sometimes because if I do have children, I wouldn't want to leave them for long stretches of time. I've been looking at other jobs, but a lot of science and engineering jobs require field work that takes you away from home. When I was a student, I didn't consider the work-life implications of my chosen field. I just pursued my passion. But now, 10 years later, I've started considering completely switching fields so I can have a more traditional office job. Lindsay, thank you so much. And, you know, Professor Kapuscinski, we have not talked about this yet. I'd love your thoughts on Lindsay's email.
Yes, I'm really glad we got that kind of question, because one thing I've reflected on a lot is that we don't really have still adequate sort of work-life balance support in our entire systems, definitely in the academic research world. And so it then makes it difficult for somebody like Lindsay. You know, if we had much greater commitment to childcare support, for example, and if we actually had more flexibility so that both the woman and the man in a husband-wife relationship had more flexibility about their work hours and their ability to, you know, share childcare, it would be easier both for the woman and the man to pursue, you know, specific demands of their jobs, in the case of Lindsay, to be able to go to sea to do her field work. So I actually do think there's a set of issues there that are still an impediment to women in these sort of environmental life sciences fields to actually stay in their career paths after their PhDs, you know, get into assistant professor jobs, get tenure, and then stay on further on.
Yeah, go ahead. I'd love your thoughts, too, Melissa.
I mean, I can speak at it from a mother's perspective as well, and I totally appreciate where she's coming from. I think even in technology, not necessarily that I was out at sea, but I did start my career at the time I was a single mom, and I had an incredible support network in my family, so I wouldn't have been able. I did a lot of trips. I did a lot of technology conferences. I did a lot of customer visits, and those things were all possible because of my family, and I think it helped me advance in my career. So I think it's absolutely key what the professor said. You need the support network, and I think I was very happy to have one, and I have one again with my husband and our third child, and I think that's where we have to get society again to be able to bridge the gap so that females have that opportunity, because I don't know that we get the same email from a male.
Thank you very much for the email, Lindsay, and what an interesting career she's chosen. So it'd be good to hear what happens. Here's another email from Sandy in Nashua, who says, as a longtime high-tech professional with over 25 years in the field, I've learned that there has to be a focus on company culture along with diversity and inclusion programs. Sandy says, after creating many mentoring programs, we learned from experience that we need to focus more on gender equality and engage the male company leaders, the ones with open minds, usually male leaders under the age of 50, who grew up in a world with more women in their engineering classrooms got it, and encourage participation. She says, so while there are so many opportunities for women to get degrees in STEM fields, the dropout often happens during their career paths because of the culture of the environment where they work. And I think this is another one for you, Melissa. You know, lots of women getting these degrees, but then there's this leaky pipeline, this drop-off. We just heard from Lindsay, who says, I might have to do something else.
Yeah, and I think that's a great point too. And the professor mentioned that she was a mentor and that her being female and being an advisor for the students helped people stay in the degree programs. And I had an incredible mentor who is no longer with Newmarket, but still a mentor to me. And it was a male. And I think that's important to acknowledge as well, is with the support network, that male mentorship and the males that support women in tech, maybe even more important at some stages than the women role models, because there were many stages in my career where I know exactly where I can look back to certain circumstances and think that could have been a make it or break it moment for me. And it was great to have that mentorship and that, and that it was a male to tell me, no, you have to keep going.
1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Luke's calling from White River Junction, Vermont. Hi, Luke. Go ahead. You're in the exchange.
I was thinking of... Hello.
Hi, Luke. Go ahead.
This is Mike from Bedford.
Oh, all right. Well, I completely got my signals crossed there.
I'll take any name.
Okay. all right. Mike from New Bedford, not Luke from White River Junction. Go ahead, Mike.
Yeah, I'm a retired engineer. I have 50 years in the profession. When I graduated WPI in 1968, it was all male. It's not that now, but being a chief engineer all these years, we're concentrating on where we get our engineers next. And the men deserted the profession in the 70s, 80s, 90s, 2000s for business and law, and women filled the gap up to 20, 25%. You can check with the panel. The point I'm trying to make as we close is if they hadn't, we'd be a third world country. There's a certain amount of engineers and scientists the country has to have to maintain its quality of life. And if women hadn't entered the field, we would have been a third world country. The foreign students are going back for outsourcing type jobs. So that's the comment and a question. We not only need to integrate more women, we need to integrate more women into the profession and talk them into it. But the gap for the last 30, 40 years in our country has been filled by women engineers and scientists.
Well, Mike, good to hear from you again, especially since you're in that field. And I'm sorry I got your name wrong. Go ahead, Melissa.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. I saw a picture recently that was back from, I think it was like World War II, and there was a woman full, it was a room full of women at like old machinery computers. And
Rosie the Riveter.
Yeah, it was like, where did the women go, right? Because again, to his point, they filled the gap then when men went to war. Somebody had to fill the gap and do that sort of engineering type work because they were in the factories and women were there. So I agree. I think we filled a gap then. It kind of lines up with the timeline I mentioned earlier around, you know, the dot-com boom when I was working alongside of many other women programmers, and then that sort of has fallen off.
All right. Well, and now I think I've got Luke in White River Junction. Hi, Luke. You're on the air. Welcome.
Yeah. Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So I just wanted to comment on two things regarding my own experiences and that of my sister. So my sister is an engineer in engineer physics. She's doing graduate work right now at Stanford. And I think a large part of the reason why she felt confident to go into that was because of something that you guys have already emphasized, which is role models. I don't really think that there's anything that's hardwired to prevent women from going into the sciences. And I think the same thing held true for myself. I went into medicine. And again, I think it just has to do with strong role modeling. And the other point that I wanted to make is that I think that having an influx of women into a field, and I use medicine as an example, actually does help to change the lifestyle in a positive way. I mean, you know, we used to be, when we were residents, working insane hours. And I think that a large part of the reason why they came up with duty hour limits was because women coming into the field demanded having some kind of work-life balance. So those are my comments. Thank you for taking my call.
Luke, very much. Thank you very much for calling in. And Professor Kapuscinski, do you want to jump in on that? Luke's point about how. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I think that really the most important point I want to make there is, you know, if we can get to the point that we don't even need to have this discussion, that there's just it just sort of happens as a matter of course that there's equal proportions of men and women in all these STEM fields, I think both the women and the men are going to benefit from that. And based on some of the comments we've been making earlier, for that to happen, we do have to have support systems that make it easier to be able to take care of families as this, and value that as much as your professional work, and have ways that those things can also be interwoven. So I think that's really the important point to make. I'll maybe just add one more point that I really appreciate the comment from the caller, just the one before the last one, about fill the gap. But I would like to get us to the point where we don't even conceive of it that way. We don't think of it as that women are filling a gap that the men left. We instead just take it for granted that you're going to have equal proportions of men and women pursuing a diversity of fields. And then it isn't that one gender is filling the gap left by another gender.
Micheline, did you want to jump in too?
Well, I do, because I think one of the things that's most exciting from where I stand in this whole conversation is that the appetite there for women in tech to share amongst themselves. So we had a week called the STEM Ambassador Week. And basically, our committee of volunteers, we have a board member, Catherine Blake, who has really led the charge. And this group of volunteers reached out and said, we want to go into the schools. We want to show folks, young women, what we do. We had over 70 volunteers, female technologists, take time out of their day to go into schools, over 13 schools over the whole state, and just have that conversation and to be able to, back to Luke's point, his experience, his sisters, how do you get that exposure? And so to be able to change that culture, there's such an appetite among female tech workers to share that knowledge, that experience.
Speaking of workplace culture, I'll throw this to you, Professor Kapuscinski, but maybe you want to jump in too, Melissa. We've talked a lot about, you know, making the culture family friendly or, you know, mentors and encouragement and so forth. What about, Professor Kapuscinski, concerns among women that if they're the only gal in the room, there could be comments, sexual harassment? There have been some headlines about prominent research professors being fired because of some of the things they say. I wonder what you think about that.
Yeah, well, again, sort of drawing on my own experience, I think I was sort of fortunate that I experienced a minimum of that when I was, you know, earlier in my career, and I often wasn't the only woman in the room, but I did experience some of that. I saw that sort of decline a lot when there were more women either on the faculty in my department or more women students in the majors or more women scientists at the professional meetings I went to. Interestingly, some of the most uncomfortable experiences I had involving sexual harassment were at professional conferences. I can remember one very early on in my career where I walked into the business meeting of a professional society and I was the only woman entering the room. And all these heads of the men turned to watch me walking down the aisle.
Yikes.
It was very, very uncomfortable.
Oh.
But once women started to major more in this was in the field of fisheries and wildlife, which was heavily male dominated for a long, long time. And once they started attending these professional meetings because they now had degrees and were now starting to work in state and federal agencies and in the private sector, for example, in consulting firms, that then began to shift. So sexual harassment still happens, but it gets exposed faster, and there's a culture of it being sort of viewed as unacceptable, whereas when I first started entering in these fields, I felt like, you know, I was the only one who was even noticing it, and there was sort of this very uncomfortable, icky feeling that it was sort of viewed as okay, you know, to harass me or to sort of make jokes about me. So I don't think we've cleaned that all up, but there's definitely been a shift where it's understood now that that's not an acceptable norm.
That's pretty intense, Professor Kapuscinski, to hear some of those stories.
Well, yeah, I mean, I could tell other stories, but we'll let some other people speak.
Well, let's go to Ruth next. She's calling from Wilton. Hi, Ruth. Go ahead. You're in the Exchange.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I know you're short of time, so I'll make this quick.
Sure.
I'm a retired college professor, and I continue to be interested in higher education. And one of the trends that is of great concern and should be of great to me and should be of great concern to everyone is that too many people are going into STEM, male or female. People are not studying liberal arts, and it's a terrible problem because people come out of the STEM programs with a different mindset than people who come out of the liberal arts. People who major in liberal arts are problem solvers, they're analytical. And just as one illustration, I was listening to it met up in your program yesterday, and the Secretary of Defense was on, and he was speaking to the point that there is one person in the State Department who has a major in Middle Eastern Studies.
So this is a really interesting way to end a program on women and girls in STEM. And a little tricky question, but she makes a point that others have made, that there's so much emphasis on STEM now. You know, programs and funding. And every other week I get an email from a politician or a group saying, look at our cool women and girls in STEM program. Micheline, I'm going to throw it to you.
Absolutely.
What do you think? I mean, are we overemphasizing this whole STEM thing to the detriment of people who might major in philosophy and can really think through things, or people in English who can really communicate well, or people who study Middle Eastern studies and can go to the State Department and figure these things out?
As much as there is a call for STEM, there's also a call for STEAM, which includes the arts. And there are a lot of folks, even in the tech industry, who yell really loud about the need for that. And I think it goes back to a collaborative environment. You need problem solvers. You need folks come in with soft skills. You need to be able to have to hit all ends of everything to have the tech industry grow. So I absolutely agree with, I think it was Ruth, in that there's a need for that. It is a collaborative effort, and there's a need to educate up in all areas.
Professor Kapuscinski, do you want to jump in on that?
Yes. So this is why I think that liberal arts education is so critical. And again, you know, I tend to be somebody who doesn't really buy into stark dichotomies. I think we need philosophers, we need poets, we need English literature experts, we need Middle Eastern people experts, and we need scientists in the STEM fields in our workforce. But we also need, in our educating, but either people who are going to major in the humanities and the arts or people who are going to major in STEM fields, we need to have education where they learn how to think about ideas across those disciplines and how to apply critical thinking skills and analytical skills to any field of inquiry. Because if you actually look at the real problems in the world, let's take something like climate change or international relations and terrorism, they always have dimensions to them that involve philosophical questions, moral ethical questions, questions about culture and history and politics, and they have scientific and technological dimensions to them. So we need people who can both talk across those disciplines, got enough in their education to kind of understand what the power is of those different disciplines, and then bring that together if we're going to solve our problems.
All right, and I will wrap it up there. I want to thank everybody for being with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR.